mankind has better maps of the moon than it does of the Arctic sea floor. And it's now time to fix that as more ships head north.
The debate over mapping the Arctic Ocean. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 6th of May. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a controversial art installation at UAA.
What it's about is questioning. As it turns out, I guess the biggest question is, what kind of a maniac would do a show about guns in Alaska?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Alaska's senators have introduced a bill that would boost the amount of money oil companies are taxed to pay for spill disasters. Their legislation comes as BP struggles to plug and clean up a massive oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. The senators want to grow the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund to $10 billion by raising the fees oil companies pay on each barrel by one penny. Currently, oil companies pay 8 cents per barrel. It would go up to 9 cents, which Senator Mark Begich says is a small price to pay.
When you think about the price of a barrel at $85 a barrel, it's a small amount of money to ensure that we have a trust fund set up to deal with these kinds of spills. And it's not the taxpayers, it's the industry.
Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski pushed an increase in the tax back in 2005 and was already working to boost it again. She says it's needed to keep up with the times and the expense of cleanups.
I think it's important to ensure that you've got a fund that is of consequence in the event that you have a disaster like we see unfolding before us in the Gulf. So I think this is one of the measures that you will see come before the Senate as we look to address the situation in the Gulf.
Meanwhile, Democrats in the House and Senate have introduced a bill that would boost the amount of money oil companies would have to personally pay for economic damages from $75 million to $10 billion. They're calling it the Big Oil Bailout Prevention Act. It could be made retroactive, so if passed, would affect BP and the current oil spill crisis in the Gulf of Mexico. Senator Murkowski says it does make sense to increase the liability cap, but she's concerned the amount Democrats are proposing may be too high. Senator Begich says he hasn't yet read the legislation that would raise the cap on oil companies' liability, but plans to look it over. He says there will be a lot of legislation in the next few weeks related to the Gulf spill.
Well, we want to be very careful of that. We're not doing emotional legislation. We're doing good, sound, long-term policy that ensures that we continue to have a healthy oil and gas and renewable and alternative energy industry for our country and making sure we have a strong energy policy that gets us off of foreign oil.
Begich says his next priority will be getting more money funneled to NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, so it can do more oil spill research and technology development. The latest uniform crime report for Anchorage shows burglaries and thefts rose in 2009. While crimes in the overall crimes against persons category fell. Two exceptions in the second group were murder and rape, KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
The yearly uniform crime report stems from statistics the Anchorage Police Department sends to the FBI, which in turn compiles a nationwide report. Yesterday, Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan and Police Chief Mark Mew released the latest report. It covers the city's crimes in 2009. From what were mixed findings, Mayor Sullivan describes the increased efforts against street crime as starting to pay big dividends.
We're really finding that focused effort on street-level crime is yielding tremendous results. And part of the statistics that you see here represents one very large case that is currently ongoing, so we can't say too much about it, but there's been a very significant seizure. Warrants still are out.
Since September, Chief Mews says vice and anti-gang units have conducted over 270 investigations with seizures of sizable amounts of drugs, about $1 million in cash, and almost 100 guns. Both the mayor and police chief say this effort against gangs and drugs seems to be affecting other crime categories. According to the just-released Uniform Crime Report, in 2009, burglaries increased 8% over 2008, and larceny theft rose over 13% from the previous year. The police chief says early statistics for 2010 may show a reversal in that trend.
We're up a little bit in burglaries and thefts this year. We're hoping that's a spike that we're going to bring down next year. We'll see when the 2010 year is over. We have taken a snapshot of the first 4 months of 09 and the first 4 months of 10 to see how we're doing. And we're down already this year, 5 in burglaries, 9 in theft. We're hoping that hitting it hard in the drug arena is pushing those numbers back down.
In other property crimes, motor vehicle theft dropped by about 12%. Arson rose by nearly 8%. The overall crime total was higher in 2009 compared to 2008, primarily due to burglary and theft increases. Murder, which can fluctuate widely from year to year, was up 50% in 2009 with 15 killings. However, the year before there were 10, and in 2007, 23. The small numbers involved can produce wide percentage differences when comparing 1 year to the next. The report shows a slight drop in robberies and a greater decrease in aggravated assaults, down by over 170 cases in 2009. One personal crime category remains high, despite considerable community efforts to counter it. Mayor Sullivan noted the continuing bleak tally.
The one statistic that we're certainly not happy about is the fact that the rape statistics are up again, and when you're already one of the highest in the nation, that's certainly not acceptable.
In 2009, there were 282 reported rapes, up 19 from 2008. Chief Mew says rape arrests have followed suit.
The arrests for rapes, they're up a fair amount this year, so I think we are making an impact on the enforcement end. But I think we got to do a lot more work on the social end before we fix this. Also, you can't overlook reporting. We have a good history of reporting rapes and sexual assaults in Anchorage and in Alaska. That's not the case always across the nation.
Rape arrests rose from 28 in 2008 to 50 in 2009. The Uniform Crime Report lists 7 hate crimes in Anchorage during 2009 with 4 arrests. 6 were against Indians or Alaska Natives, and the 7th was in the alleged sexual orientation category. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an exhibit at the Anchorage Museum that draws visitors in.
And you'll see a little crowd gathering around, and they're always oohing and aahing, because suddenly they realize, oh, they're animal tracks.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. And by BP, helping unlock Alaska's energy potential.
Mapping the ocean and what lies beneath is especially challenging in the Arctic, where ice jams the sea. But as the North warms and ice melt opens up waterways, countries are competing to know more about the seabed, especially about potential oil and gas deposits. Alaska Republican Congressman Don Young wants to dedicate money specifically to mapping the Arctic. He's introduced a bill that would spend $20 million over 2 years to develop hydrographic data and another $10 million specifically to map the extended continental shelf. Today in Washington, a House subcommittee on natural resources took testimony on the bill, including from the executive director of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission, John Farrell.
Mankind has better maps of the moon than it does of the Arctic sea floor. And it's now time to fix that as more ships head north.
Captain Farrell of NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, directs the Office of Coast Survey. He says most of the Arctic waters that do have charts were surveyed with obsolete technology, some back in the 1800s. And Lowell says most of the shoreline along Alaska's northern and western coasts hasn't been mapped in 50 years. He testified today that NOAA's budget to map the seafloor all over the nation is $100 million. But Congressman Young asked him why the Arctic doesn't have its own budget.
You're not addressing the Arctic individually.
It's not called out specifically, no, sir.
It should be, because this is where the action is going to be. Right now, we have countries that are disputing the United States, and we're on the back burner about where the borders are, where the navigational needs are questioned. And I don't think Captain NOAA has been very neglectful in their mapping. I've been through this a long time, and it's sort of, we got time, we'll take time. You're running out of time, and I want you to understand that.
Captain John Lowell with NOAA says his agency is focused on mapping the Arctic seabed as much as possible.
NOAA has invested considerably in surveying off Alaska. Much of it has been unknown for many, many years. We're watching where the cruise ships are going. We're watching where perhaps the emergency port of refuges are. We're looking at the Great Circle Route. All of these areas we're directing both contract and NOAA assets to work on. The Arctic itself has not really been accessible up until now, so we have, obviously, we can't survey where we can't get to.
Lowell says mapping the seabed is useful for navigation safety and security, especially as more ships travel north, and also for delineating the American continental shelf and understanding climate change and its growing impacts. The Alaska State Legislature appropriated $57 million for the design and further studies on the proposed railroad extension connecting Port McKenzie to the interior. The Mat-Su Borough says the rail extension would stimulate the regional and state economy. KTNA's Deanna Hecker has this report.
The Point McKenzie Deepwater Port, its industrial zoning, and the prospect of a rail extension to the existing railroad are laden with high economic hopes for the Mat-Su Borough. Borough officials welcomed the legislator's support of the project with $57 million. The legislation still awaits the governor's signature, but Mat-Su Borough spokeswoman Patty Sullivan said so far the governor had supported the rail extension. Sullivan describes the project as a huge undertaking.
This project is tremendous. It's the answer to our dwindling oil flow on the North Slope, because what it will do is create 2,000 jobs to construct the rail line itself. It's about 20 to 40 miles, depending on where it connects, from Port McKenzie to the Alaska mainline.
Borough officials are hoping that the rail connection to the Mat-Su Borough-owned Deepwater Port could jumpstart a mining boom along the rail belt. The borough is quoting three studies, including a report from Dr. Paul Metz, an economic consultant and mining geologist.
His projections are that in this corridor from Port McKenzie on up to Delta, that there's something on the order of 8,000 mineral occurrences, minerals such as molybdenum, lead, copper, I believe zinc as well. And these will stimulate new mines, and they couldn't come about without rail. Trucking wouldn't make it affordable to export those minerals.
The Mat-Su report says the economic benefits of the rail extension are from enormous transportation cost savings. The estimated capital cost of $274 million for the 43 miles of new tracks and support structures would be worth it, as an estimated annual economic benefit from metallic mineral development alone to the rail belt communities is estimated to be between $61 and $773 million. Mining companies would greatly benefit from the rail. Local Talkeetna business owner Tricia Costello said while the port and the rail extension could provide for job stability as far north as Talkeetna, but also the increased traffic would impact Talkeetna.
The very first thing I thought about was what it's going to look like at the 2nd Street crossing. We're sitting there waiting for yet another train full of limestone going down to the port, or whatever it is they're hauling out. You know, the other concern I had was knowing that they've identified the fact that the entire rail belt will be open for resource extraction, I thought, well, what kind of resource? Extraction from where? What's it going to look like? You know, are we looking at mining all up and down the rail?
What kind of mines and where they would be located are still questions to be answered, and Costello reminds area residents to stay informed.
I'm assuming that if permits are being put in by various mining companies, that's public, you know, available for us to find out, you know, what's happening as far as development and how much of that is in our backyard and not. So, I think it really is important for folks in this area to pay attention so that we really know what's coming down the rail, so to speak, and we're not really blindsided.
The public comment period started March 16 and will end May 10. In Talkeetna, this is Diana Hecker.
The authors of Ballot Measure 1 call it an anti-corruption act. Opponents say it's a gag law and held rallies against the initiative last weekend. But supporters say the law would not limit free speech or stop citizens from talking to lawmakers. This morning, Anchorage attorney Ken Jacobus spoke to the Resource Development Council about what he sees as the merits of the anti-corruption act. Jacobus says the measure has three main points. It would not allow tax revenue to be used by organizations to pay travel and other expense to send lobbyists to talk to legislators. Companies who hire lawmakers after they leave office would not be able to get public contracts for 2 years, and government contracts would be put online for all to examine. But Jacoba says Measure 1 would not limit the right for citizens to talk to government.
This law is not a gag law, as it's been called. People are as free after the law is enacted to communicate with the government as they were before. You can go to your city council and get your mill rate reduced. You're not gagged.
The act would impose criminal sanctions against those found in violation, but Jacoba says the law would lean in favor of those charged.
Anything which is arguable is interpreted in favor of the alleged violator. This principle provides further protection to someone to whom the law might be applied. Basically, the initiative hurts no one.
But it does aim to crack down on what supporters call the pay-to-play problem, with contracts going to individuals making campaign donations. Jacoba says supporters of the measure don't want public contracts traded for future jobs or contributions.
We would like to see more competitive bidding and fewer no-bid contracts. We want information available to the Alaska voters by posting public contracts on the internet. And as a basic bottom line, all of this, we want to increase the private businesses in the state of Alaska and decrease the government expenditures, and the government influence over what all of us are trying to do here in this room, and that's to develop the resources of the state of Alaska so that we have a good future.
And Jacoba says if there are constitutional problems with the measure, state lawmakers can fix it. Ballot Measure 1 will be voted on in the primary election in August.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
Two mushers in the Iditarod Trail sled dog race have tested positive for THC, the psychoactive compound in marijuana, race officials said today. But Iditarod Trail Committee Executive Director Stan Hooley said a new rule calling for drug testing isn't clear enough to allow them to impose sanctions against the mushers, who were among the back of the packers in the race. Hooley also said the identities of the two mushers who tested positive won't be disclosed, but he acknowledged they were among the last 15 competitors to reach the finish. An Iditarod attorney advised officials against taking any action at this time around. When the earlier results were announced in late March, reigning champion Lance Mackey said he felt vindicated. Mackey has been criticized for using medical marijuana in past races. Some mushers even complained it gave him a competitive edge. As the Denali climbing season gets underway, some of the most dramatic photographs of the mountain are back on display at the Anchorage Museum. 40 aerial shots from the museum's collection of Bradford Washburn's photos are featured in a summer exhibit. The late mountaineer spent as much time as he could on Alaska's highest peak. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The day when Bradford Washburn turned over a collection of his photographs to the Anchorage Museum was a big one for the organization. Dave Nichols is head of the exhibits department. He says it was a moment of real optimism for the museum.
He gave it to the museum on the evening that Elmer Rasmussen stood up on a stage over there and gave us $50 million to do the addition. And Brad was so moved by that, he said, well, I'm going to give you all these photos.
More than a decade later, the edition is nearly complete and Bradford Washburn's photos are on display. The exhibit comes back every 3 years or so and has been a popular one with tourists and Alaskans. Looking at the pictures, it's not hard to see why they draw a crowd. Most are dramatic landscapes with jagged mountain peaks rising from ice fields. But Nichols is drawn to the pictures that are a bit different. One of his favorites features a set of tracks making their way across an expanse of snow.
It's very abstract in a way. It's not obvious what it is until you have a really good look at it. And it's fun watching tourists come up to this one because they're so used to seeing McKinley and the glaciers and mountain ridges, and then they look at this and you'll see a little crowd gathering around and they're always oohing and aahing because suddenly they realize, oh, they're animal tracks. Well, that's a foot track going across the snow. And it gives you a sense of scale here because you could just see the the shadows of the trees on top. I think that was a pretty clever trick.
Washburn took risks as a mountaineer and as a photographer. He shot many of his early landscapes leaning out the side of an airplane. A few straps kept him and his enormous camera from falling out.
I always think it must have been really difficult because you have to have an incredibly fast shutter speed because the plane is rattling around. And it's a big old plate camera, so you have this big glass plate in the back, and then you can't give it a time exposure. It's got to be instantaneous, and the film must be really quick, too, because if you look at these photos, the detail is amazing. It's just phenomenal. I bet he did go up on really windy days, though.
During his mountaineering career, Washburn racked up more than a dozen first ascents in Alaska. His wife became the first woman to summit Denali shortly after they married in 1947. Washburn had many careers. He was a cartographer by training, and he established the Boston Museum of Science. Nichols says on every trip Washburn made to Alaska, he made sure to stop by the Anchorage Museum. And Nichols treasures the museum's collection of Washburn landscapes.
It's very important for us because he's such a famous, not just photographer, but a scientist or cartographer. And to have a whole set of his prints is quite something. And, he really believed in this museum, and that's why he donated this stuff to us.
The photographs will be on display at the Anchorage Museum through September 19th. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Anchorage artists and arts organizations were honored at a ceremony last night when the Mayor's Arts Awards were presented. The University of Alaska Anchorage's arts chair, Mariano Gonzalez, is among the recipients. Gonzalez is being recognized as this year's outstanding individual artist. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Mariano Gonzalez has the look of a laid-back street vendor with his colorful sports shirt and curly graying hair mostly hidden underneath a floppy brimmed hat. He could be a guy selling ice cream, but he's actually in the business of provoking thought.
I think that we need to come to grips with what we are. We need to understand what it is, and then we have to question, think about it, you know, and see if we can come to something better. This gun fetish that we have, you know, is, I think, very damaging, and it's only seems to be getting worse. And where is it going to end?
Gonzalez, an associate art professor at UAA and current art department chair, maintains a quiet sense of humor even while standing in the direct line of fire of criticism lodged at his latest exhibit.
What it's about is questioning. As it turns out, I guess the biggest question is, what kind of a maniac would do a show about guns in Alaska? And the issue here is it a good thing that we're becoming more and more an armed society, and what does that mean?
Gonzalez has taken on gun control, or the lack of it, in a work displayed at UAA's Consortium Library. It's a bold scroll of images and script stretching across most of the wall space of the little rectangular gallery. Guns create the illusion of power. Is the message beneath a photo of a woman brandishing a high-powered rifle? The photo is from an actual advertisement which proclaims the speed of a well-placed bullet trumps any 9/11 response.
But the goal is really to get people to think about the gun fetish that we have going on in this country, and in particular Alaska, and to deal with it in some way, you know, if they're come out pro or anti, it's of no great consequence to me or the exhibit. I'm here to ask questions.
The work has drawn the ire of students and been publicly panned in the Northern Lights student newspaper, yet has drawn a smattering of applause from some who've seen it. As in other Gonzalez exhibits, the viewer becomes part of the artwork by contributing handwritten comments on paper integral to the design. Many of the comments written on the wall are critical of the exhibit's point of view. Some are upset by images of Jesus brandishing a gun. Others reverently quote the Second Amendment. But Gonzalez says the Founding Fathers had no inkling of what types of weapons the amendment would protect in the future.
Well, it seems to me that Christianity and firearms are pretty solidly linked in this country. Some of the writings on the wall of people, you know, they question my use of tying the Prince of Peace with the violence. Well, you know, really, I'm not the one that's doing that. It's a lot of people who are violent, you know, both as individuals and as part of a greater organization like a country, who use Jesus or the Christianity to justify, you know, the violence that they perpetrate on other people.
Gonzalez has lived in Alaska since his parents moved here in 1959. He attended graduate school at the Rhode Island School of Design, studying metalsmithing. He says he became an artist by default, since jewelry making and a brief stint as a wedding photographer didn't pan out. The Mayor's Arts Awards recognizes 6 local artists and arts organizations. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage and Deanna Hecker in Talkeetna. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. And by AT&T, your world delivered. Details at www.att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266. Does your child not look at you when you talk to him? Are you worried your child doesn't play with other children? Or do you wonder why your child seems to be in her own world? Well, these could be the early signs of autism. For more information about autism and resources in your community, visit autism.alaska.gov or call 1-800-799-7570. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.